Before I start, I want to say thank you, Porter Square Books, for having me here. I'm having a bit of a tour of independent bookstores that remain in the country, and I myself have worked in independent bookstores, both progressive and feminist bookstores, and it really makes me happy to see a store thriving this way, because I think books still matter, just as torture still matters. So I also want to point out that I have a number of friends here, some I haven't met before and some I have, and my indexer is here, Jim O'Brien. If you ever need someone to do a really good job of writing an index for your book, you should ask Jim. Okay, so I want to do a few things tonight. I want to talk a little bit about what I mean by institutionalized state torture, and that's what the book is about. I want to give a little bit of the history of institutionalized state torture in this country and talk about how some things changed and some things were merely continuation of past practice after September 11th, after those terrible attacks. And then finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about the very deep connections between torture and the so-called war on terror and torture in the U.S. prison and jail system, which is one of the places where torture is, in fact, hidden in plain sight, even today in this country. So those are the three things that I'd like to do, and I'll leave some time for some discussion and Q&A and whatever, but let me just jump into it. So Mainstreaming Torture is a book about institutionalized state torture. So I'm not talking about the kind of things that you see on television shows every night in which individuals do terrible, horrible things to other individuals. And I'm not talking about cowboy heroes like Jack Bauer on 24 who saved the entire city of Los Angeles by torturing a single person. I'm talking about torture the way it really happens. And one of the things that became clear to me very soon after the attacks of September 11th is that both in the academic world where I sometimes live, although I've spent most of my life as an activist, but the last 9 years I've been teaching ethics to undergrads. So both in the academic world and just in the regular mainstream press, there's this tendency to treat torture as if it were a set of isolated actions, something that people or governments do very suddenly in moments of terrific pressure, and then they stop doing it. It disappears. That's not what torture is. Torture is a practice. It's an ongoing, socially embedded, complex, and collaborative activity. It has its own infrastructure. It has its own histories and traditions. It has rituals of initiation by which the people who are going to become torturers are brought into the process. And it is embedded always in a larger society. So I argue that we really can't understand what torture is and why it's so bad, not only for the targets of torture, but for the society in which it happens, unless we understand it as a continuous and collaborative human activity. All right, so what do I mean by institutionalized state torture? I've got a three-part definition, and it goes like this. It's the intentional infliction of severe mental or physical suffering by an official or an agent of some political entity which results in dismantling the target's sensory, psychological, and social worlds with the purpose or the end result of establishing and or maintaining the power of that political entity. Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. The first part, the intentional infliction of severe mental or physical suffering by an official or agent of a political entity, that actually comes from the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Inhumane, Degrading, or Cruel Treatment. And this is a convention which the United States has signed, albeit with some reservations, and I'll talk about that in a sec, and for which the United States has created what's called enabling legislation. In other words, after the United States ratified the convention in 1996, every country that did so was asked to make sure that its own local legal code fit with the convention itself. So the U.S. passed a law that that did that. So what were the reservations that the U.S. had? Number one was they were concerned about the definition of mental suffering. There was concern that this concept was not clearly enough defined in the convention, that people wouldn't be able to tell whether or not they were inflicting mental suffering on someone. And so they wrote reservations that said essentially that nothing in our signing the convention can be construed to disagree with any existing U.S. laws or practices of the federal government, right? So there are two theories, at least, about why this was. One theory is that this was done primarily on the part of the CIA, that the CIA advocated for this reservation because since the end of World War II, they had been engaged in a long, ongoing program of paying for research into brainwashing, essentially, at U.S. and Canadian academic institutions. Alfred McCoy is the historian who has done the most work on this in a book called A Question of Torture. And so what went on for a long period of time was that people in psychology departments especially were experimenting, oftentimes on unwilling people who were patients in mental institutions, with sensory deprivation or the opposite, with sensory overload, with the use of various kinds of prolonged exposure to sleep deprivation, interference with the timing of meals, control of food and eating, and all of these designed to, in a sense, reverse engineer the ways that people who had been captured by the U.S. in North Korea had been treated by the North Koreans. And the CIA described in their manual that the ultimate goal of this research was into the best way of establishing what they called a regression. In other words, creating from an adult human being an infantile person who would essentially be pliable with the agency that was holding them. And so they called this DDD. They wanted to create a condition of DDD, which is debility, dependency, and dread. So the concern was that because this research program was still perhaps going on, and certainly its learning was still being used, one theory, and this is Alfred McCoy's theory, about why the U.S. had so many reservations about signing the convention, is that they didn't want interference in this work, this ongoing work of research. Another theory that some other legal scholars have advanced is that actually the concern was much more about what the United States was doing to people that it was holding in its own prisons, and at that time in the mid-90s, particularly in what were called supermax, or still are called supermax facilities, where people are held for 23, 24 hours a day in 8x10 cells underground with no natural light, fluorescent light, and a video camera with no human contact, sometimes for years. And the concern was that if there were no reservations in our signing, that other people might look at this treatment and say, oh, sorry, you've signed a convention that says you won't do that. So those were some of the reservations. Now, as we know, this legal language was used, in fact, to question, to ask whether or not the United States was engaged in torture in the proceedings of the so-called War on Terror. And one of the first things that happened is that the CIA actually asked the White House Office of Legal Counsel for some guidance, some help interpreting this language, because the language, especially of severe pain and suffering, was too hard to understand. And so a famous memo was written in 2002 by Jay Bybee, who is now a federal judge, and John Yoo, who has now just recently been given a special endowed chair at Bolt Hall Law School at University of California in Berkeley. So these folks, although they are famous for this, have not suffered terribly, although I know someone who knows Bybee personally who says that he actually has had a very hard time as a result of having his name on this memo. So, in any event, what the memo did was it attempted to unpack this problem, this problematic language of severe pain and suffering. And so what they said about physical suffering was this, that in order to constitute torture, it would have to be the kind of pain that was so great that it would ordinarily be associated with a sufficiently serious physical condition or injury, such as death, organ failure, or serious impairment of bodily functions. So basically, if the target doesn't die, or his spleen doesn't stop working, or his kidneys, then it really doesn't quite count as torture. And you might think this is bizarre, but in fact, this is exactly the same kind of logic that you see in people who talk about the torture they do. So, for example, while I was doing my research, I read a book of interviews with a man named Osvaldo Romo. And he was a torturer in Chile under the Pinochet regime. And at one point during the interview, the reporter, who's a woman from Costa Rica, is asking him, so, but you know, you did torture people. And he says, well, I applied electrical current, but that's not torture. And I would say, as far as Bybee and you are concerned, that probably isn't torture. Okay, then there was the problem of what was meant by severe psychological suffering or mental suffering. And here what they decided was the guidance would be that it only counted, it only rose to the level of actual torture if it would last for a period of years or even decades. Well, it's kind of hard to predict when you are in the middle of behaving in a certain way towards someone whether or not what you're doing to them is going to last for decades. In fact, impossible. So this was a useless guidance. However, as many people realized as they read the rest of the memo, its main purpose was not so much to guide the members of the CIA as it was to give legal cover, so that should they later be prosecuted for anything that they might have done in the course of the war on terror, they would have this legal cover. When the memo was leaked in 2004, it was immediately rescinded, and a milder version replaced it. But the fact is, the damage was already done. Okay, so we have a legal definition. There's a lot more to it. There's more to the enabling legislation. If you're curious about the details, it's in the book. And there are other excellent works about the legality of torture that are out there. Let's talk a little bit about what I said about dismantling the victims or the targets' sensory, psychological, and social worlds. So what do I mean by that? And this is where I rely to some extent on the work of a woman named Elaine Scarry. Has anybody heard of her? Okay, good. So Elaine Scarry is one of my great intellectual heroes, as I told a friend of mine here. And she wrote a book that, if you haven't read, is a brilliant book called The Body in Pain, The Making and Unmaking of the World. And in it, she talks about the effects of torture on the individual human being. So in a sense, it's what a philosopher might call, or a sociologist might call, a phenomenological approach. And what she says is that torture essentially constrains and shrinks the world of the person who is its target. So this begins with the physical body. If you've ever experienced intense physical pain. Has anybody here ever had that experience? The kind of pain that you just can't stop paying attention to? You know that in that moment, that is the only place where you can focus your attention. And so physical pain has the profound effect of shrinking your world down to the contours of your own body. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that your temporal world shrinks. And sometimes this is done intentionally. So one of the ways that people will be manipulated in a torture situation is that their sense of time will be intentionally distorted. So, for example, they'll be brought two meals in a row and told that it's been 6 hours. Or they won't be fed at all and then told that they were just fed, you know, they were just fed 6 hours ago when it's really been 24 hours. If there is a clock on the wall, it will be messed with. Anything to shake up their connection with the ordinary world. And one of the effects of this is that it reduces the person to a sense that they're living in a permanent now. And, you know, it's one thing to want to be here now as a meditation practice. It's another thing to be here now when you don't have any choice about there being any time at all. So one woman, a British doctor who was tortured under Pinochet, described it this way. She said, it was as if there was no time. You were suspended over a pit, and there was no future and no past, only this moment. So the world has shrunk to the contours of your own physical body. Your sense of time has shrunk to this sort of permanent now. And then your social world is completely constrained so that your only relationship is with the people who are torturing you. And human beings are fundamentally, at base, social animals. We, by nature, create bonds with other human beings. This is one of the reasons why solitary confinement is such a terrible form of torture, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, because the animal that we are needs contact with other members of the species. So one of the ways that the social world is destroyed that it's particularly important is that when a person is tortured, what she is asked to do, the pretext is always going to be information. So she or he is asked to give up information about the people who are members of the social bodies that she belongs to, whether it's a sewing cooperative, a Christian-based community, a union, a political party. The point is to get that person to betray the other members of that organization, or even friends and family. And so, who here read 1984? Okay, all right, so you may laugh, but I asked my class of undergrads this the other day. They don't teach it anymore. I think it's because the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, and so, you know, nobody's using Orwell to attack the Soviet Union anymore, so they don't teach 1984. But you probably remember at the end of the book, Winston Smith, the hero, he's being held by the party. And he's been tortured, and he has agreed that 2 and 2 make 5 because he actually believes that that's true under the pain of the torture. And he has, you know, become a ragged, ugly, degraded creature. And O'Brien, his handler, says to him, "Is there anything that any degradation that you have not experienced?" And Smith says, "Well, there is one." And you probably remember, O'Brien says, you haven't betrayed Julia, who's his lover.
That's right.
Right? So they take him to room 101, which is the room where the most terrible thing in the world is. And for Smith, that's rats. And they attach him to this contraption. They tell him that there are starving rats in this cage and that they're going to lift the gate and allow the rats to come and eat his face. And in that moment, he realizes that the only thing he can do to save himself is to put somebody else's body between himself and the rats. And he realizes only one person will do. And he screams, "Do it to Julia!" And in that moment, he's completely broken. That's the end. And this is, in fact, what happens in real torture. So that over and over again, people who have been tortured will, you know, hold out and then finally give up a name or an address or something, only to hear, "Oh, we already knew. We just wanted to hear you say it." So why? What's the point? Well, torture only does its work if it's not entirely secret. torture only does its work if it's at least somewhat open. So what happens is you take a person who's been tortured in this way, a member of an organization, you put that person back out on the street, and everyone can see what has happened to him or her. They can see how broken she is. They can imagine what secrets she might have given up. They can begin to realize that they don't trust either that person or each other. And it's like a poison that seeps through the entire organization. And if you've ever worked in a political organization, back in the 60s, we used to ask ourselves this a lot, you know, is there an agent here? And you'll know that much worse than what any agent can actually do is the suspicion and distrust that grows in the organization. And so the fear that the same thing will happen to you and the distrust, the breakdown of solidarity, are very powerful ways of attacking the threats that might exist to a regime. And so one of the things I like to say is that torture is a way of attacking social bodies by attacking the bodies of the individuals who make up those organizations. And that brings me to the third part of the definition. So we had a legal part, a phenomenological part, and this is the political part of the definition. This is what torture is for. The purpose of torture is the destruction of organized resistance that might represent a threat to the regime in some way. Now, that's not how torture is described by the people who do it, right? It's always about the interrogation. Torture is about information. It's about actionable intelligence. So my argument is that it is very possible that the people who are at the lowest level of doing torture may believe that, or they may not. It's certainly clear that those who develop entire torture programs, whether or not they consciously are aware, they do it because it works, at least in the short term, to destroy the organizations that are a threat. We don't have to prove that Dick Cheney believed that torture was a good approach for the United States because that was his goal, to say that they continue doing it because it appears to be effective. So this gets into one of the primary arguments in favor of torture, which you're going to hear all the time. And it's so famous, it actually has its own name, the ticking time bomb problem, right? This is the Jack Bauer problem. This is, you have in front of you an individual who is a terrorist who absolutely, without a doubt, knows how to stop the bomb that is otherwise going to kill hundreds of thousands of people within 2 hours. Do you torture him? This kind of hyperbolic, hypothetical argument is a red herring. This is not how torture works, because you can't torture someone on the spur of the moment. Torture requires an infrastructure. It requires people who are trained to do it, who know what they are doing. And like any complex set of skills, it requires practice. And if you think I'm kidding, I can tell you that in Brazil, under the generals, it was practice for the police to go out and round up people who were living on the streets who had no homes and bring them in. And with U.S. assistance, and particularly the assistance of one individual who's known to us named Mitrione, they actually would take these people and in front of a class of 100 cadets would torture people whose only crime was that they lived on the streets. And then the cadets would practice. So you can't torture someone on the spur of the moment. Torture doesn't work that way. It's a practice. It's an ongoing thing. Okay, so after September 11th, some things changed and some things were simply continuations of previous U.S. government practice. So the thing that changed is that very suddenly, within a couple of months, really, of those terrible attacks, we began to see in ordinary press people saying, we've been attacked, somebody needs to be tortured. It was almost an automatic response. And so one of the most famous ones of these, and I feel sorry for this guy, his name is Jonathan Alter. He's a historian. He's written a story of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He's written other books. But he also was a columnist in Newsweek. And in the November 5th edition of Newsweek, 2001, so, you know, a month after the attacks, he wrote, "In this winter of our autumn of our anger, even a liberal finds his mind turning to ... torture." And then he goes on and says, "We need something to jumpstart the investigation into the greatest crime in American history." So I want to pull that apart a little bit because there are a couple things that are key. Number one, for myself, horrible as September 11th was, and I have friends who lost people in those attacks, I don't consider it the greatest crime in American history. I might, you know, maybe the genocide of the people who lived here before the Europeans got here, maybe slavery, probably not September 11th. But secondly, we'll note that here we're not looking at torture as a means of preventing a future attack. He's talking about torture in order to find out who's to blame for this attack so they can be punished. And then he goes on and he says, well, you know, maybe not electric prods, but, you know, certainly we could use drugs on them or send them off to another country like Saudi Arabia, the land of beheadings. And this is interesting because that activity of sending someone somewhere else to be tortured is explicitly prohibited in the Convention Against Torture. And it has a fancy name, Extraordinary Rendition. But he was already proposing this in November of 2001. And he said that anyone who wasn't willing to change their ideas about law enforcement after September 11th was living in a hopelessly September 10th world. And they had really not understood how things had changed. And this was the line also that the Bush administration took as they began talking to Congress about what they were going to do about these attacks. So we see Cheney, Dick Cheney, vice president, for example, telling Congress, we're going to have to do some things in the shadows. We're going to have to work on the dark side. Kofor Black, who was in the NSA, also went up to Capitol Hill and said there was a before 9/11 and an after 9/11. After 9/11, the gloves come off. And so it already was clear to anyone who was looking that some terrible things were going to be done. And so I began thinking about this right away. Now, the people that Alter was talking about torturing were actually a specific group of people. There were around 600 Muslims who were picked up in the United States. Most of them were here legally. They either were legal permanent residents, some were citizens, some may have been here on expired visas. Many of them were held for as long as 6 months and some for as long as a year without any contact with anyone, without access to a lawyer. If this had happened in Latin America, we would have said they were disappeared. And they were held primarily in jails in Brooklyn, New York, where they were tortured. They were short shackled, which means essentially that you are held in a position like that for as long as 23 hours a day. And one of the most powerful and effective methods of torture is actually what they call stress positions or stress and duress. And the reason for this is twofold. Number one, it leaves no marks, but it can cause a pain that is as profound as any kind of pain that's caused by electrical current or other methods. But, and this is the second part, you are doing it to yourself. And so one of the things that the CIA discovered in their research is that pain that you cause yourself through your own body does not create the same level of resistance as something someone else is doing to you. In fact, it creates a kind of extra layer of shame because you are, in fact, not only allowing this to happen to yourself, but you are doing it to yourself. And so they were short shackled, these men. They were exposed to extreme temperatures of freezing cold while wearing almost nothing. They were beaten repeatedly. They were sexually humiliated. Some of this will sound familiar because it's the kind of thing that we later saw at Abu Ghraib. And at least in one case, one of them was raped anally with a police flashlight. These people were eventually released. Not one of them was ever charged with anything that had to do with terrorism. Some of them were deported because they were on expired visas, and the rest were allowed to go home. These are the people that Jeremy Alter was sure should be tortured, which points to the fact that we really cannot be sure that the person we have in front of us is the person who is guilty of some crime. And, you know, this is sort of why people have trials, right? To find out if they're guilty. Okay, so, however, as I said, it's true that there was this break in the kind of settled consensus that torture is always wrong, we don't do that. That had really grown up since at least the 1970s, and really since the time of the atrocities of the Holocaust. There was a settled agreement both in the academic world, in ordinary, you know, mainstream press, and among ordinary people that torture is not something the U.S. does. In reality, of course, the United States had long been involved in torture. And I'm just going to talk about the post-World War II period. I'll talk a little later about earlier in the U.S. history. But just talking about World War II, or the time after World War II, we'll start with the Vietnam War, during which there was the Phoenix Program. People have heard of the Phoenix Program? Okay, so this was a program that of torture and detention that was designed to break the Viet Cong and their resistance to the South Vietnamese Army and the U.S. Army. And the U.S. basically took over after the French left Vietnam. The U.S. began to take over, and the French kind of said, you know, you guys don't want to do that. This did not end well for us. It's not going to end well for you. But we didn't listen. The U.S. went into Vietnam, and they adopted French practices, including the use of the field telephone, which you crank up to create a large electric charge, which is then discharged into the body of someone you're torturing. This was also used in Algeria, and it moved from Algeria, actually, to Paris during the 1960s, and was used in Paris police offices. And this is one of the things about torture, is it doesn't stay put. It moves. It goes wherever the people who do it go. So the kind of tortures that people were exposed to in the Phoenix program, and we're talking about tens of thousands of people, it was called pump and dump. And the idea was that they were pumped for information, although, again, information isn't really what they were looking for. And then they were dumped, literally, oftentimes alive, from helicopters into the South China Sea. And the kinds of tortures that were involved were things, I'm going to now describe just one set of tortures that were used under the Phoenix program. The use of a wooden dowel driven from one ear to the other through the brain of a person who's a detainee, obviously killing the person. Holding someone in a tiger cage, a very tiny confined space, until she starved to death. And then all the other kinds of torture that we're used to, including the use of the field telephone on the genitals and so forth. So this became known in the United States, and there were actually hearings. Jay Rockefeller held hearings about it in the 1970s, and the end result of the hearings about what the CIA had been up to, both in the United States in terms of its experimentation with people in this country, and in the Phoenix program, led to an executive order signed by Gerald Ford, which said, CIA, you may no longer have permission to assassinate foreign heads of state, and CIA, you may no longer experiment with drugs on citizens of the United States. So, yeah, it's there, you can go find the executive order on the web. It's there. So, because they had been playing around with LSD and stuff to see if it would work to create this kind of regression. In addition to what the CIA was doing directly, the U.S. was also involved in training and assistance to torture regimes from Greece to the Philippines to most of Latin America. And the most famous site of that is the used to be called the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. Congress finally gave in to pressure to close the place and changed its name. They didn't actually close it. It's now the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security and Cooperation. But if you want to do something about torture, every November, around the time of Thanksgiving, there are a series of demonstrations outside Fort Benning, Georgia. You can go and participate in those and let your country know you don't like the idea of training other people's armies to torture people. So the U.S. provided military support, training, and all kinds of assistance to torture regimes around the world. So when the U.S. began to be involved in direct torture in the war on terror, it wasn't really a departure. One thing that was new was that it was the first time since 1975 that we had done it in the context of a foreign war. And the other thing that changed was how people felt about it. That suddenly, as it became clear that this was happening, there began to be a change in how people in the United States reacted to the idea of torture. And this is what really concerned me, in addition to the fact that people were being tortured. So part of the reason I wrote the book and that I even am involved in this issue is because I was fortunate enough in the 1980s to spend time in Central America. And in 1984, I lived for 6 months in the war zones of Nicaragua. And during that time, the U.S. was, the year I was there in 84, was illegally funding, because Congress had said they couldn't do it, the Contra, which was the counter-revolutionary force who were trying to overthrow the Sandinista government that had thrown out the dictator who was supported by the U.S. And if you followed that, great. If not, I'll run through it again. So I met people who had been tortured, and I met people who had tortured. And one of the people I met was a guy who had been kidnapped by the Contra, taken to Honduras, to the northern, which is north of Nicaragua, where one of the two main bands of Contra were. And there he was tortured specifically with exposure to extremely cold water for long periods of time, which is one of the things that we have since learned the CIA was doing. And during the war on terror, and eventually sent back into Nicaragua as a fighter, because that was part of their strategy. They kidnapped people, they tortured them and brutalized them, and then sent them back to do the same thing to the people that they were attacking. And the strategy of the Contra, the conscious intentional strategy, was what you would call terrorism. It was to frighten the civilian population, not only by killing them, but also by mutilating them and torturing them and leaving their bodies to be found by other people. So I knew that my country had already been involved in this, and that's why I started to write the book. But as I worked on the book, I began to realize that although I focus a lot on the history after World War II, that in fact U.S. involvement in torture goes back much further. And really, we can't talk about U.S. torture without talking about race in this country. Every torture regime that decides that it's going to be involved in a program of torture identifies one or more groups of people who are legitimate targets for torture. This goes all the way back to ancient Greece. The Greeks believed, we're talking now before the Common Era, the Greeks at the time of the Greek democracy, the Athenian democracy and so forth, believed that it was impossible to lie under torture. And so people who were simply witnesses to crimes would be tortured, because you would get true testimony by torturing them. We now know that it's very easy to lie under torture. It's just as easy to lie as tell the truth. And in fact, sometimes you don't know the difference when you're being tortured. But it was believed that free men should never be exposed to torture, because they were capable of choice, which meant they were capable of virtue. and they were capable of living a good human life. Slaves had no choice in their lives, so they were essentially not human in the same way that free Greek men were human. And so they were legitimate targets of torture. One of the things we know, though, is that any torture program, the targets tend to expand. The circle of people who are legitimate targets gets bigger. In all of these cases, what happens is a group of people are identified, and they are identified as not only being legitimate targets, but legitimate targets because they are not fully human. And you find this a lot in the language. So in Chile, the people who were tortured were called humanoid rather than humans, as if they were quasi-human but not really human. And of course, when we talk about the United States, the very beginnings of torture, really the country, before there was a country, began with torture, began with the torture that people in this country or people that Europeans did against the native population who were living here, and then very much we see it with slavery. So I want to say that since I published the book, I've really learned a little bit more about this. I mean, in the book I talk about the relationship of torture and slavery and say that slavery absolutely involved torture, but I understand a little bit more now why. First of all, obviously, people of African descent who were enslaved were not considered human beings. In the Constitution, they were 3/5 of a human being. So there's very clear that from the very beginning, there was a designation of this group of people as not entirely human. I've been driving around the country with my partner, Jan, and doing these talks, and we've been listening to books on tape as we go. So we listened to a classic history of the state of Virginia by a man named Edmund Morgan, and it came out in the 1970s. And what he talks about is how the experience of how the economy of Virginia developed is a microcosm for understanding why torture was, or why slavery was absolutely central to the founding of the United States and to the US economy. And so one of the things that he talks about is how in the beginning, the people that were working the fields for the landowners were Europeans, they were Brits, who were brought over. Some of them were accused of crimes and were scooped up on the street and transported. Some of them came believing that, you know, if they signed a contract for 7 years of labor, at the end of it, they would get a piece of land and an opportunity to work the land and so forth. But once they were here, whether they came voluntarily or not, there was always the possibility that if they did the work, if they didn't run away, if they didn't get in trouble for some other crime, eventually they would actually finish their contract, they'd get those 50 acres, they'd be able to farm tobacco themselves. When they began importing enslaved people from Africa, those people had no possibility that if they did what they were told and they worked hard, 7 years or 14 years later, they would be set free with 50 acres and a mule. It wasn't going to happen. And so they had no incentive to do what the landowners wanted them to do. And so the landowners very consciously recognized that only the infliction of pain would be the motivation that would cause enslaved people to work, because otherwise they had no reason to work. And so physical pain, whipping, branding, short shackling, all of the things that we have come to know as torture begin with slavery. And of course, torture continues after the Emancipation Proclamation, and we see this in the use of now free African people, people of African descent, who were in the hundreds of thousands actually sold. Once they fell afoul of the U.S. criminal justice system in the South, they were actually sold to mines and to farms as essentially slave labor, only this time for a period of time. But the same kinds of torture were imposed on them to make them work in the mines and in the fields after emancipation as before. And then we come into the 20th century and we see the quintessential 20th century form of torture of African American people, which is lynching. And this also in California was extended to people of Mexican descent. And lynching actually continued up into the 1970s. I moved to San Francisco in 1980, and in 1981 or 82, there was a man lynched in Richmond, California, and left. He was tortured and hung from a tree. He was a transgender African-American man. And it's the last lynching I know of. But in the South, this was a regular occurrence, and it was institutionalized state torture. These were agents of the state, oftentimes in civilian clothes, but clearly who approved it. It was used to control and frighten that group of people who represented a threat to the regime, as my definition gives. And so then I just also want to talk a little bit about torture in U.S. prisons, because it's a continuation of that same trajectory. And it's one that we don't think about a lot, because we kind of take it for granted that people who are in prison are going to experience bad things, and that perhaps even they deserve it because they must have done the crime, they should do the time. You probably all know that since 1975, we have seen the U.S. prison population go from 200,000 to 2.5 million. So we have a huge number of people in prison today. Many of those people are living in solitary confinement. Usually, a very few of them are people that you might call political prisoners. They're in prison for many years for actions that they did in the 60s or 70s. But most of them now are people who have been identified as gang members. And it's important to understand that prison gangs are actually a creation of the prisons themselves, that the segregated housing that's used to separate people who are in jail actually leads to the formations of these gangs, and they're made and manipulated by the prison officials. But in any case, once you're validated as a member of a gang, you will then, in many cases, and I'm talking especially about my own state, California, which I know best, be liable for housing what's called a secure housing unit or a SHU unit. And this is one of those cages where you are 24 hours a day without human contact. Your meals come into you through a slot in the door. You might have an hour off for exercise up and down the hall by yourself. And yet, as a result of solidarity among these folks, last year in 2013, 30,000 people in California prisons went on hunger strike at the same time as people were on hunger strike in Guantanamo for the same reasons. And those reasons had to do with indeterminate sentences, never knowing if they were ever going to get out, and solitary confinement, which, as I say, is a horrendous form of torture. One of the people who most famously was treated that way in the War on Terror is a guy named Jose Padilla, who was accused of having created a dirty bomb. And interestingly, another guy named Binyam Mohammed, who was shipped to Morocco and tortured in most horrific ways involving scalpels and his genitals that I won't go into, the reason he was tortured, the thing they wanted him to say, was that he knew Jose Padilla and that he had created a dirty bomb. So finally he said it. But anyway, Padilla was held actually in the U.S. in a Navy prison for 3 years in solitary confinement. And by the end of that time, he could not only could he not help with his own defense, when anyone went to see him, like his lawyer, he would be found in a fetal position in the corner, hearing voices of people that weren't there and shaking. And this is what solitary confinement does to the human person, to the animal. We just can't bear it. So it's interesting to me and wonderful in a way that there was genuine intentional solidarity between these people in California and the people in Guantanamo, who, by the way, are still being tortured to this day. And when I say that, what I mean is, in addition to the things that might have happened at the secret areas in Guantanamo, I'm talking about force feeding. So you know that when people are on hunger strike, the U.S. government has decided that it's legitimate to force them to be fed. And this is done by strapping someone into a chair, putting straps on their arms and legs, but also very tight across the stomach, and then a nasal tube is forced down the nose and ensure is pumped into the person's stomach. And there was recently in the New York Times an op-ed by someone who had had this done to him in Guantanamo. It was called Gitmo is Killing Me. And he talked about having this done twice a day. And he says, the feeling is as if you have to vomit, but you can't. And that the pain is the most intense he had ever experienced in his life. And they're doing this to him and to hunger strikers in prisons around the U.S. twice a day. So one of the reasons that torture still matters is that torture is still going on. And it's going on both in the ongoing war on terror. The executive order that President Obama signed in 2009 said that the CIA was no longer allowed to use its enhanced interrogation techniques, but they are still allowed to render people, send people to other countries, supposedly with the proviso that they not be tortured. But if that's not going to happen, then why are they being sent? But also, it didn't say anything about any of the other agencies that are part of the whole national security apparatus that includes both the military and civilian agencies, and especially the Joint Special Operations Command, which Jeremy Scahill has written about so importantly, which is joint because it's joint, it includes personnel from the various armed forces, including some of the Navy SEALs. And these are people who are essentially given carte blanche to do whatever they want. They had their own interrogation system in Iraq that's separate from the interrogation system of the CIA or of the Army. And it was a place called Camp Nama, N-A-M-A. And the famous slogan that was up on posters on the walls was, "No blood, no foul." In other words, as long as you don't make the person bleed, you can do whatever you want to them. And nothing has limited what JSOC is doing, as far as we know. And their work is expanding. We know, because it's in the New York Times, that they are now in Africa, supposedly, to assist in the interrogation that that the Nigerians are doing in order to stop Boko Haram. Now, I'm not saying that Boko Haram is a good organization or an organization that I would want to live next to. On the other hand, as we know, torture targets have a way of expanding, and the U.S. is very interested in controlling what happens in a number of countries in Africa because there's a lot of resources there. And so we know that JSOC is in a number of places in Africa. We also know, because it was in the UK Guardian a couple of days ago, that there is still a prison on the edge of the Bagram Air Force Base where the United States military, and we don't know who, but probably JSOC, are holding prisoners. Now, the U.S. turned over all the Afghan nationals that it was holding to the Afghan government about a year ago, but these are people who are not Afghans, who are foreign fighters, and the U.S. is still detaining them. They are some of the most secret prisoners there are. They also have been on hunger strike because of their treatment and because they don't have good access to the International Committee of the Red Cross, which they're supposed to have. So it's still happening, and it's still happening in our jails and prisons. So I want to finish by saying, we can stop this. This is not something that has to happen forever. We can stop it. If we don't stop it, we're going to become a nation of cowards. We're going to become a nation of people who are willing to allow anything to happen as long as I am guaranteed my own personal survival. And that is the definition of cowardice. And cowardice, like all the vices and virtues, is a habit. And I think it's a very bad habit. I think it's one we don't want to develop. So we need to stop it. And we can. I've actually brought some flyers with me that my partner is happy to pass out that give you some ideas about things that you can do, organizations that are working on these issues. And I want to give a special shout out in that context to Massachusetts Peace Action, which is one of the best organized and active chapters of a wonderful organization. And you folks should definitely get connected if you aren't already. And I just want to finish by reading a tiny bit from the book. This is a story of something that happened to me that explains a little bit about why I do this work. So, sometime during the early 1990s in San Francisco, California, I attended the speech of a Salvadorian trade unionist. Her name was Gloria. I had traveled to El Salvador myself in 1989 as the interpreter for a Solidarity delegation. At that time, the U.S.-backed Salvadoran government had a strategy of kidnapping, torturing, and often murdering mid-level leadership of trade unions, which they understood to be a threat to their power. And the idea was to take out that middle level of leadership as a way of wiping out the power of the unions. We were able, indeed, during the 2 weeks while we were in El Salvador, one of our union liaison members was arrested. We were able to visit him a few days later in prison, where he described how he had been tortured and the particular methods that they used. So Gloria's purpose that evening in San Francisco was to inform her audience about the dangers in El Salvador to union members like herself. By way of illustration, she related the story of her own capture and torture by the notorious Salvadorian Treasury Police. She told us that it was only the pressure of phone calls and letters from La Solidaridad Internacional, International Solidarity, that had finally forced the police to set her free. And as Gloria began to speak, I began to shiver. I remembered that I myself had heard her name before, and I had spoken her name before, because I myself had made some of those phone calls. This happened because my friend Sharon Martinez organized an informal phone tree among her Spanish-speaking friends. When news of police kidnappings reached her from El Salvador, she would provide the necessary information to telephone the appropriate police force or military service, and El Salvador had a bunch of them, and demand the victim's release. In those days, things were not that formal with the Salvadorian police and military, and you actually could know the phone number that would ring on the warden's desk. So I actually remember calling down to Ilopango, to the prison at Ilopango, and talking to the warden and saying to him, I know you have this woman, Gloria, because she was seen going into the prison. I know that she is being tortured. You must release her. People in this country know what's happening. You must let her go. So Sharon would keep us updated with what was known about the victim's whereabouts and supply us with the relevant telephone numbers. That night, I remembered my phone calls to the Treasury Police, remembered insisting that we knew that they had Gloria. And I remembered talking directly with the head of the prison there. So as Gloria told her story, I was seized with this kind of retrospective horror. What if we had been too busy that day to add, in the days of her capture, to add our voice to those of others who were demanding that she be released? What if no one in this country had sought to understand and counteract the practical implications of our own government's policies? But there was Gloria, alive and continuing her work. We had better get on with ours. Thank you.